Chapter 6, Essence of Bear. Our answer was to come from halfway around the world, from a land very different from the jungles our moon bears had known. But here, too, nearby mountain forests had once harbored bears, until the land had been irrevocably altered. Grizzly bears once roamed the pine-covered Bitterroot Mountains of central Idaho. Looking like great mountains themselves, their 800-pound bulk surmounted by the peak of a great shoulder hump, some 100,000 grizzlies inhabited the lower 48 states in the 1820s. Today, only 900 American grizzlies are left outside of Alaska. Those from the Bitterroots are gone. Just west of the Bitterroots, much of Idaho's northern panhandle is composed of rich, rolling farmland known as the Palouse, former prairie where Nez Perce Indians raised spotted ponies that became known as Appaloosas. Today the hills are clad in lentil and wheat. White farmers began staking homesteads here in the 1870s. They eradicated the Bitterroots grizzlies. They seized the Indians' prairies. They replaced the ponies with pigs. The roots of the wild camas lily made perfect food for swine. The biggest town was known as Hog Heaven. In the Chamber of Commerce spirit, town fathers quickly switched to calling it Paradise Valley. But in 1877, when a farmer named Samuel Neff filed for a postal permit, he formally gave the community the name it has today in honor of his hometown in Pennsylvania, Moscow. It was here that state leaders chose to build the state's land-grant educational institution, the University of Idaho, in 1889. And it was here, more than a century later, where we sent the hair from the moon bears. In their heavily padded Federal Express box, our test tubes passed beneath the glass eyes of the two mounted elk heads that guard the foyer of the university's College of Natural Resources. Through a door, down a corridor, and through another door, our samples entered the reception area of the Department of Fish and Wildlife Resources, where visitors are greeted by a stuffed cougar playing with a grouse, a stuffed fox dismembering a partridge, and two living secretaries. The samples were delivered to a tiny corner room, decorated with photos and cartoons of bears and the artwork of children, and occupied by a slender 30-year-old brunette, the office of Dr. Lizette Waits, mother of two young sons, long-distance runner, and one of the world's top experts on the molecular genetics of bears. At her lab, the hairs we had collected would be utterly transformed. Their cells burst, their subcellular parts purified, their DNA chemically parsed into submolecular units, analyses so different from our work in Southeast Asia, it seemed impossible to believe that both were aspects of the same science. The recipe for life is written in an alphabet of only four letters, A, C, G, and T. Each of these letters stands for a nucleotide. Adenine, cytosine, guanine, thymine, nitrogenous bases. Each adenine reaches to its partner, thymine, and each cytosine to its guanine, across the DNA molecule's dual backbone of phosphate and sugar, like rungs on a twisting ladder. The order in which these nucleotides appear codes for the production of amino acids. Amino acids, of which there are 20, in turn string into polypeptide chains. A gene is the set of nucleotides that codes for one polypeptide chain. Polypeptide chains make up proteins, and proteins make up us. Each mammalian cell offers two sources of genetic material. The comparatively weighty nucleus of the cell contains nuclear DNA, with about 30,000 genes. DNA from the tiny mitochondria contain fewer than 40. That mammalian cells contain two types of DNA reflects an extraordinary event that occurred perhaps 2 billion years ago. The modern cell arose from the fusion of two different cell types when big cells swallowed little cells and for some reason did not digest them. The little cells that ended up living inside the big ones are known as mitochondria. Mitochondria resemble bacteria. A billion of them would fit into a grain of sand. But they produce all of a cell's energy, consuming the oxygen we breathe to help us burn the food we eat. Their genes contain the recipe for cellular energy production. Mitochondrial DNA divides, evolves, and is inherited separately from nuclear DNA. Nuclear DNA is inherited from both parents. Mitochondrial DNA is inherited only from the mother. There is no recombination from mating as there is from nuclear DNA. The tiny sperm cell has only 50 to 100 mitochondria, and those few are usually destroyed by the huge egg containing tens of thousands of mitochondria. Gary had earlier explained to me why mitochondrial DNA is particularly useful for tracing lineages, and thus identifying species and subspecies backward through evolutionary time. Both sorts of DNA mutate occasionally, the professor explained, in that a particular nucleotide changes identity spontaneously and randomly. Nuclear DNA has repair mechanisms that reverse many such mutations, but mitochondrial DNA does not. And mitochondria reproduce very rapidly. As a result, mitochondrial DNA evolves much more rapidly, on average, than does nuclear DNA, something like 10 times the rate of nuclear DNA, and at a rather regular rate. So it is something like a ticking clock. The idea of the molecular clock is based on this set of simple and reasonable hypotheses. As species diverge from a common ancestor, they accumulate mutations on DNA in a random and thus fairly steady manner. The longer two species or lineages have been separated, the greater the amount of divergence. The amount of difference, called the genetic distance between the two, would be roughly proportionate to time elapsed since their ancestors diverged from one another. Working backward with a matrix of genetic differences between species, mathematical methods can be used to construct an evolutionary tree, similar to the trees genealogists construct to trace their ancestry. And in fact, analysis of mitochondrial DNA has led to some of the most astonishing breakthroughs in the study of human ancestry. In the mid-1980s, geneticist Douglas Wallace of Emory University in Atlanta, with the late Alan Wilson of University of California, announced they had found the African Eve. By tracing distinct changes in mitochondrial DNA in blood samples taken from humans around the world, they found all modern humans are descendants of one woman who lived in Africa 200,000 years ago. Lizette sent our DNA results to Gary by email in October. He shared it with Sun Yin and me at a meeting at a Chinese restaurant in Chicago. Sun Yin was back in grad school by now, apparently cured of his stomach ailment. Now he was accompanied by his beloved Lena, the couple having married that summer. Gary, thoughtful host and gifted storyteller, waited until we had dispensed with small talk and settled into our seats. He cleared his throat as he does before a lecture. "The results are very exciting," he said, "but they are exciting in a way I didn't at all expect." He paused. "Shall I?" he asked me ceremoniously. I nodded assent, and he began, as fine teachers always do, at the beginning. We had considerable reason to be worried about whether the hairs would in fact yield viable DNA results, he told Sun Yin for the first time. However, in fact, almost all the Cambodian and Thai samples gave very good results, I'm happy to say. All of our samples had turned out except two, Luke, whose hairs we'd pulled at Lopburi, and, more disappointingly, the pathetic little female cub we had taken such risks to find in the Elephant Mountains. And all the golden bears, from the thin female from Mong Rati's plantation to the elderly Bertha from Lopburi, were identical on all base pairs examined, Gary said. Such a sequence of base pairs in nuclear DNA is called a genotype. On mitochondrial DNA, it's called a haplotype. Interestingly, he explained, the panda-like bears we had sampled, Romeo, whose hairs Johan had harvested with his bare hands at Banglamong, and Dave from Lopburi, shared the golden bear's haplotype, too. "Do we have a new species, then?" Sun Yin asked anxiously. "It certainly would have appeared so. Except," said Gary, "for one of the black moon bears, the male at the Senator's Zoo at Prey Ving. He has the exact same haplotype," he told us. "The genes are the same. So this, together with the fact that we've seen every possible intermediate between completely blonde and completely black in the bears, suggests to me strongly that we're looking at two color phases of the same sort of bear. Sun Hyun looked disappointed. "Wouldn't this be comparable to, say, discovering the first white tigers in India?" I interjected. "They're actually a color phase of the Bengal tiger, the same species. And there are other examples of color phases, aren't there?" Sun Hyun brightened. "I think one is the black leopard, and also I have heard information about the white elephant." "Yes," Gary agreed. "Our golden bears were not," he stressed, "extremely rare genetic accidents like five-legged cows. They appeared to be a normal, though previously unknown, color variation in the wild. It's still a matter of great biological interest to know there are multiple color phases within any species," he told us. "Variation is what biology is all about. We've discovered something that's new. We're describing something that's new. That no one has documented this before is amazing." He paused to let us consider this. Of course, we were disappointed that the golden moon bear wasn't a new species. Nonetheless, this discovery was important. But this news was not what had gotten Gary so excited. "Now, the other interesting fact, though," Gary continued, "is that among the bears that we got haplotypes for in Thailand, and not all of them necessarily caught in Thailand either, there are, in all, three distinct genetic haplotypes. And they are so different, there must have been hundreds of thousands of years of geographic separation between them. And this means that at least within Southeast Asia, we're looking at very distinct groupings that perhaps became separated during an earlier time when there was less forest available in Southeast Asia, and bears became isolated." This was the part that so fascinated the professor. "Having collected a very small number of samples, we were already seeing evidence of three deeply separated moon bear evolutionary lineages, one of which, the lineage which included the golden bears, we could already correlate with geography. Even if animals look alike, if we can show they are genetically different, and if we can show they are predictably different in different parts of Southeast Asia, we may be able to name different subspecies in different parts of Southeast Asia," Gary pointed out. "We might not have a new species, but we might still discover the next best thing, a new subspecies. And that was not even the most exciting part. What intrigued the professor was that we had quite unexpectedly stumbled on a way to solve a mystery even deeper than discovering the identity of golden bears. How and when and where did these bizarre shaggy things get to be in this strange tropical place?" he'd always wondered. "They are as out of place as an Eskimo in the tropics." Now we had a way to find out. We had found, in the lineages revealed by the DNA, a way to see back into time. Changes in the nucleotides, as they occur over time, record the bears' ancient histories. By comparing their similarities and differences, we could sort them into groups within groups, creating lineages that, like those wooden Russian dolls, nest one within another within another. The relationships between the ever larger groupings could be shown as a branching tree, and if we could expand our sample size and match each group with a geographical location, the tree's branches, limbs, and roots could be plotted against a map to suggest to us the routes the pioneering bears had taken as they colonized the strange new tropical world of Southeast Asia. We would need to return to Southeast Asia, of course. We needed to collect many more samples. We needed to cover as wide a geographical area as possible, and it was essential that we get hairs from bears whose capture sites were known. But if we could do so, the rewards could be rich. A mitochondrial map could reveal to us the barriers that might have, in the distant past, cut off the different lineages of bears from each other, forcing them to evolve for millennia in isolation. It could show us vanished refuges where such evolution had taken place. "It's incredible," said Gary. "After yanking these hairs out of the moon bears we've met, we can find out where these big shaggy bears actually bumbled around 100,000 years ago. It's even more incredible than looking at fossils." And the importance of our work was not just academic. Once we could match each lineage with a geographical location, our mitochondrial map could become an important conservation tool. If one were to reintroduce captured animals in the wild, Gary told us, one would probably want to try to reintroduce them in an area where they are the same haplotype. Once we had developed a lineage map of Southeast Asia's moon bears, a handful of hair from any captive animal could tell us the area to which it could be returned. Our work could fuel the first project in the world to use molecular genetics to return formerly wild bears to their homelands. The three of us gleefully launched into a series of toasts. To the golden moon bear, Gary offered. To Sun Hyun and Lena's marriage, I added. To His Excellency Chun Sareth, Sun Hyun cried. And to our future expeditions. We might have toasted, too, the blessings of chance and faith. The message in the Japanese story of the woman's quest for the hair of a moon bear was true for us, too. The bear hairs had proven invaluable, but not for the reasons we had expected. And we had acquired our greatest treasures not by our own carefully laid plans, but by chance along the journey. Unwittingly, we now found ourselves on a path to discoveries with profound implications for both science and for conservation. This project has more plot twists than one of your whodunits, I said to Gary. That's why I love science, he replied. Sun Hyun urged us to return to Cambodia to continue the research. He was also eager to mount an expedition to search for the mysterious Kating Vor, known from its horns alone. No one's written any paper on that yet. Maybe next, he suggested, we could combine the search for more moon bears with an expedition to northern Cambodia, where his surveys found hunters reported these buffalo-like animals with some frequency. Also, Gary and I hoped to further map the golden moon bear's range into Laos, and Gary Van Zylen had generously invited us to sample hairs from any of TSCWA's projects in Thailand. As we floated ideas for our next expedition that evening, we couldn't imagine that the next twist in the plot awaited us far closer to home.